In 1824, Ralph Waldo Emerson described China as a booby nation. That was still a commonly held view in the West when scientist Joseph Needham visited Asia a century later. He was astounded by the scientific advances the Chinese had made throughout their history, and he recorded them in his book, Science and Civilization in China. Simon Winchester called his recent biography of Joseph Needham the man who loved China, and he spoke about it on the show this past spring. We thought that it bears re-airing, so we're playing it again now. I began by asking Simon Winchester how he'd heard of Joseph Needham in the first place.
Well, I didn't know anything about him at all until about 1995, I think, and I was writing a book then about the Yangtze River, and I needed to know something about the design of junks, sailing junks, that how they were light enough and strong enough to be pulled up against the current to go through the Three Gorges, the famous or infamous Three Gorges. And someone said to me, well, there are two classic books that are about the design of Ming and Qing dynasty junks, and that's G.R.G. Worcester, The Junks and Sampans of the Yangtze, or Volume 4, Part 3 of Joseph Needham, Science and Civilization in China. Never heard of either, but went to this remarkable bookstore, now defunct, sadly, in Salisbury, Connecticut, a chap called Mike McCabe, who's not defunct. And I said, Mike, have you ever heard of Junks and Sampans of the Yangtze? He said, oh, G.R.G. Worcester, yes, we've got a copy of that, $25. So I said, you're amazing. You've never heard, have you, of a book called Science and Civilization in China? And he looked at me as if I was an insect. He said, you mean Joseph Needham? I said, yes. He said, you've never heard of him? The most famous Englishman ever to have lived in China. Extraordinary book, 24 volumes long. Occasionally we get single volumes, and I think we've got one downstairs, and he went downstairs, volume 4, part 3, the very one I wanted.
Although they're still publishing updates, aren't they?
Well, they're still publishing entire volumes. The one on ceramics came out 2 years ago, but that's now 13 years after Joseph died. So there's an institute in Cambridge which keeps the flame alive and keeps publishing the books. There are now 24, which is, you know, 3 million words. It's an enormous, I mean, it's like an encyclopedia, a great monument to human learning.
Well, here's this man who was, what, he was a biochemist?
Yes, he was a biochemist, an expert on the egg. He was an embryologist, really, in Cambridge in the 1920s.
And what got him involved with China?
A woman, I'm afraid to say.
Not his wife?
Not at all his wife. His wife, Dorothy, a blameless left-wing academic, much like himself. And I think their lives would have unrolled seamlessly as just left-wing intellectual scientists. But in 1937, a young Chinese woman called Lu Guizhen came to study in Cambridge, and Joseph, who was a bit of a ladies, well, a very considerable ladies' man, fell for her. And they fell in love. And
Could they have gotten married? Did he divorce his wife?
Well, no. I mean, Dorothy was complacent. And the extraordinary thing about it is that the three of them became the best of friends, and they would go away to China, among other places, together. When Dorothy died in 1987, aged about 92, so Joseph married Lu Guizhen, who had been waiting in the wings for 51 years.
But they had an open relationship.
They had a very open and very sort of Cambridge left-wing, do what you whatever pleases your relationship.
And she taught him to read, write, and speak Mandarin.
Yes, I mean, that's really what began the whole thing. She taught him Chinese, and actually it's rather, I think, charming that the first ever character of Chinese that you see in his diaries is written the day that he and Guizhen first, without being vulgar, consummated mm-hmm. their relationship. And I often ask people, what do you think that first character was? And they say, oh, love or China. Well, it wasn't. It was cigarette.
Well, at least they knew what was important at the time.
Indeed, yes.
But that was before we knew everything about cigarettes. She obviously had a major influence on him beyond being the woman he loved.
Yes, hugely so, because she kept saying to him, look, you, like most Westerners, and like most Westerners have for the last several hundred years, regarded China as a backward nation, as you quoted Emerson at the beginning, I mean, this booby nation. And the country had, after all, fallen into ruin. I mean, it was being nibbled away at, gnawed away at by the great powers, the British ever since 1841 when they took Hong Kong, and the Germans had taken Shandong, and the French had taken Hainan, and, of course, the Japanese. were now at war and had occupied a third of the country.
So and then there was a civil war going on top of
that. There was a civil war. There had been a revolution. A 2,000-year-old empire had fallen, and Sun Yat-sen was in power, and the warlords. So the country was a complete ruin. But she said, remember, she said, if you learn the China that I know exists, you'll realize that it is a country that invented so much so early and is a great, great civilization. And that's what she taught him.
But he was sent on a diplomatic mission, wasn't he? I mean, he's a biochemist.
Well, it's odd, isn't it? But basically what had happened was that after the Japanese invaded, all the great universities of eastern China migrated westwards to free China. It was a bit as if all of eastern America was occupied by a foreign power, and Harvard and Yale and Princeton and Columbia decided to load all their books and students onto donkeys and march, whatever the weather, to Denver and Salt Lake City and set themselves up again. That was what was happening in China in the late 30s. And the British government took the view, we must help these universities so that they don't, so that China's intellectual life doesn't die. And they looked around for an academic who spoke Chinese to go and help them as a British diplomat. And they selected, of all people, there were two candidates. One was a philosopher and the other was Joseph Needham. And they sent Needham, and he travelled for 4 years or 3.5 years all around China under very, very trying circumstances to go to these universities.
With Lu Guizhan?
Some of the time. She was at the time, first of all, at Berkeley until she got an allergy and then came here to New York and studied in Columbia. She lived on Haven Avenue, which was a street I didn't realize existed, way up in the north of Manhattan. And he...
So she's a female Asian professor in American universities. That had to be an oddity in itself.
Yes, she wasn't really a fully-fledged professor. She was lecturing, it is true, at Columbia. She was a researcher with some teaching responsibilities. And then she eventually, Joseph, persuaded her to go over to China and join him.
My guest is Simon Winchester, whose latest book is The Man Who Loved China, the fantastic story of the eccentric scientist who unlocked the mysteries of the Middle Kingdom. It's published by Harper. Well, when did he realize that China was behind some of the greatest civilizing achievements of the world?
Almost from day one. I mean, there's a lovely note in his diary when he flies to Kunming. He first arrives in China in the spring of 1943. He comes in from Calcutta, and it was everything that he dreamed of. I mean, by now he was obsessed with this image of China that Guizhan had told him about. So on a spring day, he's sitting in a garden in Kunming watching someone prune an apple tree. And suddenly he realized that the way the man was pruning it was different from the way his father pruned the apple tree in the back of their house in London. And he started taking notes. And he thought, my gosh, maybe this Chinese pruning technique is much more ancient. So he started looking into it. And he started looking into other things. He had, for instance, a robe made a few days later. And he looked at the abacus and thought, wow, this calculating engine, maybe this is terribly antique. And this started him on this quest for what the Chinese did first.
And you have 11 pages of these accomplishments, which include everything from the things we might assume, gunpowder, to stringed instruments and a lot of other stuff. And yet, why wasn't it better known around the world? Was this partly because of the way China was structured?
Yes, it was. I mean, there was for a long time, and ever since the ill-fated Zheng He expedition, after which the Chinese forbade foreign travel. I mean, the Chinese did not really spread their inventions except that those went through the trading routes into Arabia. But generally speaking, what the Chinese had invented was overlooked by the West, because from the 15th and 16th centuries onward, the ferment of invention was taken over by the West, and particularly after, obviously, the Renaissance. And so the West disregarded China. It wasn't until Needham started looking into it. I mean, the classic example of this is Francis Bacon made this famous remark about the three inventions that really changed the world were printing, gunpowder, and the compass. Well, at the time he said that, he had no idea where those three things were first invented or first utilized. Needham proved that they were all Chinese, but so were dozens of other things. The stirrup, vaccination, toilet paper, for heaven's sake.
Bookworm repellent.
Indeed, quite worm repellent, yes.
And the crossbow. I mean, it's just amazing. Well, why was gunpowder invented? they didn't have guns.
Well, they did. You see, that's there we are. With great respect to you, I mean, that's the Western bias. We thought they only used gunpowder for fireworks. Not at all. Needham looked into this and found that they made bombs. And there is a very interesting coda to this story. Needham was, you may well know, banned from the United States for 25 years. He was forbidden from coming here for something he did in the 1950s in Britain.
Well, he was considered a communist.
He was almost a communist, but he had taken the side of the North Koreans in saying that the Americans had used biological weapons during the Korean War. And for that, the State Department said, sorry, you've got to leave. But
there has been evidence that that was the case, actually.
Well, yes, and I devote a long chapter to it, yes. But the State Department at the time said, well, I'm sorry, Mr. Needham, however distinguished you may be, you're not coming in. When he finally was allowed in 1978, by which time he was master of his college at Cambridge and a towering academic reputation, he was given an honorary degree by the University of Chicago. So he flew here in May 1978, first time for 25 years, gave a lecture on gunpowder and showed a design of an early Chinese gunpowder-based bomb. Who was in the lecture theatre? May the 24th, 1978, Ted Kaczynski.
Oh.
And 6 weeks later, exploded a bomb which killed a security guard, the bomb, the precise design that Needham had displayed. So maybe the State Department should have kept him out.
Did the Chinese keep a list of the inventions that they had created over the years?
They did, because internally they were enormously proud of everything they had done. And there are these gigantic books. I mean, we think of our encyclopedias, you know, Britannica and the OED and other things as being monumental. There are encyclopedias produced in China 1,500 volumes long. I mean, these are things that fill entire rooms, and they list. But
did he go to those books when he compiled
did.
His book?
Well, he did, and also after he had left China in 1948, initially to go to Paris to help set up UNESCO. He's the man that put S into UNESCO because they were going to leave science out and call it UNICO, but he persuaded them otherwise. An anonymous person sent to his rooms in Cambridge, rooms which incidentally are now occupied by Stephen Hawking, so I think that's a rather nice symmetry there. They sent him these huge encyclopedias. So the work began in a way once he got home and started reading all these documents.
What sort of reception did Science and Civilization of China incur when it was first published in 1954?
Rapturous. I mean, he was terribly nervous about it, Needham, because of the reputation that he had got from this the Korean War business. And so he was very, very worried that it wouldn't be received. First three volumes, which one might call throat-clearing volumes when he was sort of setting out his agenda, everyone thought was just wonderful. And since then, it settled down to be the best book on China ever written.
Did he remain a Maoist to the end?
That's one of the things that people say was rather fat-headed about him. He had considerable reputation in the academic world, and he could have stood up and said no to the Cultural Revolution or no to the Great Leap Forward, or more significantly, he could have said something trenchant about Tiananmen Square. But all the time he wanted to keep access to China to go back and do his researches, and so he kept quiet. And a lot of people fault him for that.
Well, he was a rather colorful character in other ways. He was a nudist, but he was also a churchgoer while he was a communist.
That is so strange. He was an ardent and committed Christian and an ardent and committed socialist. And he, indeed, also a very, very keen nudist and a very good dancer, this rather peculiar, rather wild pagan dancing called Morris dancing. And he was adept at the accordion. Someone said, well, at least he didn't when a nudist played the cymbals. That would not have been fun.
Do you think he foresaw China's future as a mass producer of consumer products?
I'm not sure that he saw that, but he did see China as returning to the ascendant. And I remember once when I had gone up the Silk Road last year, actually, following various routes.
You felt it was necessary to retrace his steps?
I thought it would be.
Does it really matter?
I thought it'd be enormous fun and help. I mean, a wonderful trip to take. I mean, he had the most extraordinary adventures, and to the extent that I could sort of follow them, I would. And I came across this little town, which famous only as being the place where rhubarb is said to have originated, a place called Jiuquan in Xinjiang province. Now it's China's most remote and most secret space center, where their satellites go up from, and indeed where the single orbiting Chinese astronaut went up. And there's a sign in English outside which says, without haste, without fear, we shall conquer the world. And I think Needham would have exactly understood and probably sympathized with that.
Was the trip an adventure for you too, or has China been so modernized that it would be very different than what Needham experienced?
Well, indeed, it was very different, but I had the most extraordinary adventures. And I one thing which comes to mind was in the middle of the Silk Route, when at about 8 o'clock on a very cold night, when I was in the Gobi Desert. The Gobi Desert's on the right. You can see the tumble-down sort of far western Great Wall, but very, very lonely. We hit a rock, and all the oil poured out of my car. So suddenly, I'm on a lonely stretch of the Silk Route on the Gobi Desert with a car which is absolutely immobilized. So I sat there thinking, what the hell am I going to do? Because the nearest town is 220 miles away. Extraordinarily, and this is part of the Chinese gift, in making the infrastructure for the new China, they've put up cell phone towers everywhere. Well, I had my BlackBerry with me, and I switched it on, and sure enough, there was GPS signal, which was meant I had telephone signal, but there was also, I thought, I can't believe this, there's GPRS, which means I can get data. Somewhere, there's a cell phone tower. I got data, therefore I got on the internet. I'm sitting in this ruined car. I thought, I can do a Google search. So I searched hotels, Dunhuang, China. Up came a list of hotels. I clicked on one. Over the static, phone rang. A woman answered in English, and she said her name was Mary. How can I help you? And I said, Mary, I'm at a town about 220 miles to the east of you in a broken-down car. She said, don't worry, leave your flashes on. In about 5 hours, we'll be there. And 5 hours later, two sets of headlights came. One was a crane to take away the car, and the other was a car with beer and noodles and two guys to take me to Dunhuang. So the new China is a remarkable place.
Are you going to turn up more eccentric characters like this gentleman and like the one you wrote about in The Professor and The Madman, about the men of letters who helped create the Oxford English Dictionary?
Well, one hopes. I never look for them, and they just seem to sort of accidentally pop into my life from time to time. But for the moment, Needham will do it, because I'm next doing a book about the Atlantic Ocean, so who knows who will pop up in that.
Or pop under in that. Anyway, Simon Winchester's latest book is The Man Who Loved China, the fantastic story of the eccentric scientist who unlocked the mysteries of the Middle Kingdom, that scientist being Joseph Needham. And the book is published by Harper's. Thank you so much for being with us.